Don't look so disappointed. It's okay. It's a quarter till. I'll keep this as short as possible. Depends on what your definition of short is. Impossible, right? We've been looking at the Old Testament. We've been exploring the Old Testament through the prism of their culture. Things that were a part of their culture that we don't necessarily know, we're not necessarily familiar with, that affect the text, that play out in the text that we don't necessarily see, but it makes the text pop. It makes it come alive when you finally see it. And we've been doing this long enough that we've finally come to that generation that is going to faithfully enter the land of Canaan after the previous generation chose to stay in the desert for 40 years. We watched as Israel comes into the land, and under the leadership of Joshua and Caleb and their peers, they follow the Lord, they obey the Lord, and they conquer city after city, 31 cities in all, 31 kings fall. And in his old age, Joshua tells the tribes, okay, I'm getting old. In fact, God told Joshua, Joshua, you're getting old. I'm getting old, you have to finish the job. 12 tribes, take the land. Don't compromise. Don't tolerate, take the land. And the people very quickly, each tribe very quickly compromises and tolerates. They embrace, after all they have seen God do, after all the miraculous things they've seen God do, they embrace the people and they embrace the culture of the people and they embrace the gods of the people and they worship the gods of the people in the land, and it becomes a very debaucherous thing, detestable thing. And as we look at the book of Judges, we have a verse at the very front and a verse at the very back that sort of bookend this. And these are the two verses. Judges chapter 2, verse 10, there arose another generation after them, after Joshua and Caleb and that first generation that came in, there arose another generation after them who did not know the Lord, nor the work that he had done for Israel. How astounding is that? And the other bookend at the very end is Joshua 21:25. In those days there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And during this book, we see them go through a cycle. Don't compromise, don't tolerate, but then they disobey. And they compromise and they tolerate, and they embrace the culture, and they embrace the gods, and they worship the gods of the people in the land. God removes his hand of blessing from them and imparts his hand of discipline. And that discipline looks like letting the people of the land embrace them back. He's literally saying, you believe that the system around you can protect you? You believe that the system around you can provide for you? You believe that the system around you can bless your life? Have it! You can have the system. I'll step back. Have the system. Have the culture. Have the world around you. And watch as it represses you, then oppresses you, and then enslaves you. He's literally telling them, have the system, because the system is going to have you. And the people around them begin to oppress them and enslave them and hold them down, terrorize them. And the Israelites fall into despair. The funny thing is they're not falling into despair because of their sin. What have we done? They're falling into despair because of the consequences. Oh, our life is so terrible now. But they cry out to the Lord. It's kind of like they remember his name. And cry out to him. And then he sends a deliverer. He sends a judge, what we call judges. And the judge comes in to free them from the oppression of the people around them. He's going to save them from the enemy that enslaved them. Now, There's a pragmatic principle that you can learn here, a principle that you can just apply to your life and the world around you. Never compromise, ever compromise with people who want to destroy you. Never compromise with people who want to destroy your way of life. Never compromise with people who do not honor God's ways. Never compromise with people who do not honor God's word. Never compromise with godless, God haters. They will never compromise with you. They're on a mission. That's a pragmatic principle. But in a very spiritual sense, the deeper application that we're supposed to see here is the fact that the people that they allowed to remain in the land were the same people who ended up enslaving them all over again. In our lives, the sin that we allow to remain, the sin that entices us, allures us, seems convenient, we like it, the sin that we allow to remain in our lives is the sin that will enslave us. It becomes the habit, becomes the problem. It dogs us. And we're going to go through the same cycle, that disobedience. Allowing this sin to remain, and God removes his hand of blessing and imparts his hand of discipline. And far too often we fall into those difficult times, those hard times, and we have despair. And we cry out. It brings us back to the Lord. We cry out, and he delivers us. Today, we're going to talk about a very popular story in the book of Judges. And it has sets of characters. And I want to make sure that everybody understands who the characters are as we go through. We have Deborah, she's a judge. And Barak, he's a warrior. Deborah and Barak. And then from the Canaanites, we have someone named Jabin and Sisera. Jabin's a king. Sisera is a warrior. Now we have this other couple over here that's sort of floating around. His name is Heber, and his wife's name is Jael. So Deborah and Barak. Okay, everybody good? Deborah and Barak. Then we have Jabin and Sisera. All right? And then we have Heber and Jael. Okay, that's who we're going to talk about. But before I do this, I've heard some of the craziest explanations given from this story about Deborah. We're going to be looking at Judges chapter 4 and 5 if you want to turn there. These explanations don't come from within the text out. They come from people's presuppositions as they look at the text. And I want you to see them before we go through this text, because I don't want you to have any false understandings of this. Number one, there is no room for presuppositions that demean Deborah's position. Okay? I actually heard with my own ears in this church, from this pulpit, many years ago, this statement. Isn't it a sad state of affairs that God couldn't find any man in Israel to use, so he had to resort to a woman? I was a little kid when I heard that. And I thought, as a little kid, what a load of bunk. That's amazing. I sort of looked around, expecting someone to shout, and everybody was going, yep, how sad. How demeaning is that to women? How demeaning is that? There are at least 8 other female prophets in the Bible that God uses in wonderful and mighty ways. Deborah is the first prophet that we have seen in the text since Moses and his sister Miriam, who was a prophet as well. And keep in mind, that Miriam was a prophet while Moses was the leader and probably one of the greatest leaders Israel ever had. So don't demean Deborah's position in some chauvinistic way. God is using her in a mighty way. Number two, There is no room for presuppositions that exaggerate Deborah's position. I have actually heard this story used as a Christian feminist manifesto. Okay? How arrogant is that? To use a story from the Bible to promote our own social agenda. The Israelites were not in the throes of a feminist revolution. No, the men couldn't take the land, so the women have to show us how it's done. We keep coming across a verse in Judges that says, there was no king in Israel. There was no king in Israel. In those days, there was no king in Israel. And I don't believe that that statement means that they should have a king like all the other nations have a king. I think it's weightier to say they don't recognize the king that they have, God. God, sitting on his throne, the mercy seat, to the Ark of the Covenant, in the Holy of Holies, in the tabernacle. Things have gotten off track. We should be asking, where's the high priest? What has happened to the high priest in Israel? Officiating, bringing messages from God to the people. Where are the priests? Where are the Levites? Where are the warriors who walked in and saw this fighting and saw Joshua and Caleb be successful? Where have they gone? Where are the people who are going to resist the cultural demise? The cultural embrace of God's chosen people embracing the world around them. This is not about male versus female. Chapter 5, verse 7 gives us the answer to why Deborah. Why Deborah here? Deborah says, I, Deborah, arose. Which literally means, I stood up. Why Deborah? Because she took a stand. While her people are embracing the culture around them, and it is embracing them back, she stood up. I love the way in which she identifies herself. She identifies her role. She doesn't say, hey, I'm a judge in Israel, or hey, I'm a prophetess of God, or I'm the rightful leader right now. She says, I'm a mother. I'm a mother in Israel. She seeks the Lord. She listens to the Lord. She relays what the Lord has given her to relay, the message. She settles disputes. She comforts, she encourages, she accompanies, and she inspires. Third, number three, there is no room for presuppositions about Barak's manhood. Barak is not a coward in this story. There's so many examples of great men in Scripture who hesitated after hearing God's calling or hearing God's instructions. They go, wait a second. Acts chapter 7 tells us that Abraham hesitated in obedience because of family issues. In Exodus chapter 3, Moses questions, who am I that I should go? Can my brother come with me? Or how about Judges 6, Gideon? It seems as though Gideon is literally asking God for a photo ID. Before I go and do what you've got to prove yourself to me, Gideon is saying. Jeremiah 1, Jeremiah tells God, I'm too young for this. I am way too young to do what you're asking me. This happens a lot with this hesitation. So don't call him a coward. It's very likely that Barak wants Deborah to come with him while he goes into strategic battle against a far superior army, because it's obvious that God is talking to her to talk to him. So, come on, let's go. I'm not leaving you behind. You got to be with me out there. It's very likely that he wants Deborah to accompany him because she is known nationwide. While he is only known, his reputation is pretty much confined to the tribe of Naphtali, which is a small tribe. And number four, I've heard this before. Don't read into her response, "Yeah, I'll go with you," but a woman's going to get the credit. That's not exactly what's going on here, as if she's saying, "I'm going to get the credit." What ends up happening in the story is this woman, Jael, Heber's wife, she gets the credit, and she's not even an Israelite. So Deborah is saying, "Yes, surely I will accompany you, but I'm not getting the credit, you're not getting the credit, Israel's not getting the credit, the woman over there is going to get the credit." That's what's going on. Hebrews 11 commends Barak for his faith. It doesn't call him a coward. Now, I've spent some time this morning, about 10 minutes, telling you what not to see. Don't bring our social constructs to the text. Don't put them on the text. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about what you should see behind the text. What is going on here? The enemy, first, the people who are oppressing the Israelites, these Canaanites, they are led by Jabin and Sisera. Jabin's not necessarily a name. It's a title. Like Pharaoh. Pharaoh's not a name. Pharaoh's a title. It means like king. Okay? Jabin means king. So it's a title. Now we first saw Jabin, king of Hazor, in Joshua chapter 11, and he's defeated. He's conquered by Joshua as they're coming into the land. Since that time, he's regathered the Canaanites, he's regathered his people, and he's taken back the city of Hazor. And he's propped himself up as king over Hazor there. His right-hand man, his chief military commander, is a powerful warrior named Sisera. His strength lies in a regiment of 900 iron chariots. Remember, the Israelites are still using copper because the Philistines are not letting them have iron or showing them how to make iron. When copper goes to war with iron, iron wins. Okay? And he has 900 iron chariots. This is extreme in those days. This is a mobile army. Think of a battalion of tanks taking a battlefield against foot soldiers. How's that going to go? And by the way, Jabin's tactic, the Canaanites' tactic here, is to kill all the men, take the women as slaves, and plunder the towns. And that's why in the text you'll read, no one was living in the towns. No one was living in the cities at that time. You couldn't be there. You had to be hiding out in the hills, hiding out in the fields. Number two, the Kenites. Have you guys remember? How many of you remember the Kenites? No one? See, aren't you glad I'm here to remind you? Moses marries a Midianite. Moses' father-in-law is a priest of Midian. The descendants of Moses' father-in-law, the descendants of Moses' brother-in-laws, become the group of people named the Kenites. Can you imagine what Moses' in-laws thought of him? I think a better relationship than I had with my in-laws. Can you imagine? Wow, my son-in-law is the one who led the nation out of Egypt. My son-in-law is the one who led them across the Red Sea. It's got to be something to have Moses as an in-law. It appears as though the Kenites, some of them believe in God. It appears as though some of the Kenites have a really good relationship with the people of Israel. It appears as though some of the Kenites come in and actually camp in the southern part of Israel with the tribe of Judah. and they're living there with the Israelites in a really good relationship because they're sort of in-laws with Moses. Now, there's a man named Heber and his wife Jael. They leave that region. They leave that tribe, and they go up to the north, and they make a peace agreement. They make a personal treaty between Heber and Jael and Jabin and Sisera. They make this agreement to live well among them, not to the Israelites in the south. One little cultural tidbit that might interest you, with these nomadic people, the Kenites, who move from area to area, and area like Heber and Jael just move from the south to the north, while the men are shepherding the flocks and guarding and defending the paths for the family to take, it's the women who put up and tear down the camp time after time and move after move and trip after trip. These women are doing hard labor. And they know how to use hammers and tent pegs really, really well. And that comes into play in this story. So, first of all, don't put our presuppositions from our culture on the text. And it's also very important to realize what's behind the text. Who are the characters? Why are they called? Who are the Kenites? Who's Heber and Jael? You should know these things. Now, look at Judges chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. The sons of Israel again did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. We talked about Ehud last week. And the Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin, king of Canaan, who reigned in Hazor. The commander of his army was Sisera, who lived near Harosheth-Bagayim. See that word again? Again, evil. The verse doesn't tell us explicitly what they're doing, but we can infer that it's the same thing, because it's again, as they've been doing before. Not resisting, but compromising with the culture around them, embracing the culture around them, and then the culture embraces them back. Worshiping the gods of the culture in the most detestable ways. Notice the word there, the Lord sold them into the hands of Jabin. This is not really about Jabin. It's not even really about Sisera or the 900 iron chariots. This is all about God. Who's in control here? Jabin? Who's in control here? Sisera with his army of chariots? Nope. This is God's hand. God's in control. They're killed, they're raped, they're plundered, they're enslaved, and they're hiding, running, on the run for 20 years. And so they cry out to the Lord, not because they're repenting for their sins, but because their life has become very, very difficult. And that brings us to Deborah. Deborah comes on the scene, and she summons Barak. She's going to give Barak a message from God. So, behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded. She's telling Barak, go and march to Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and from the sons of Zebulun. I, and she's referring to God, God is the one giving the command, I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots, his many troops, to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hand. Now remember something here. Throughout all history, all cultures, all over the world, repression always begins with disarmament. The Israelites have had all of their weapons taken away. We talked last week about a man named Shamgar who had no weapons. He had an ox goad. Judges 5:8 tells us that no shield or spear could be found among 40,000 soldiers in Israel. So think about it. Deborah is telling Barak that God has commanded Barak to take a bunch of men who have no weapons and go and fight a trained army of the ruling king in the land, who has a very strong military spearheaded by 900 iron chariots. What would you do? What would you do? Barak, of course, wants Deborah, who is relating this message to him, to come with him. Obviously, God is choosing to speak to me through her. He is saying, I might need to hear a word from the Lord when we get to the battlefield. I want her near me. And she says, surely I will go with you. So he gathers his army and he goes to Mount Tabor, just east of the Kishon River. Now remember that it was God who said, I will draw Sisera out to you. Remember the Kenite named Heber, who moved up north and made an alliance with Jabin? He's the one who goes and he tells Sisera, hey, the Jewish army has arrived at your borders. The Jewish army is on the other side of that river there. Does that make Heber a traitor? Maybe he's playing double agent. Maybe it's just God using Heber to bring Sisera out to the battle. And Sisera is willing to bring his iron chariots, but what do we know about iron chariots? Extremely heavy. They're really, really heavy. He brings them to the valley of Megiddo. Sound familiar? So much stuff happens at Megiddo in the text. It's not funny. He brings these iron chariots to the valley of Megiddo, right next to the Kishon River bed, because it's the dry season. It's all dried up. The ground is parched. The ground is hard, and the chariots can stand there. This is perfect place for battle. A flat plain with hard ground for the chariots to just run roughshod over these unarmed men. Remember who the Canaanites worshipped? Do you remember the name? Baal. God of the storm. Voices heard in thunder. His power is seen as lightning. He gives us the rain. The rain gives us rivers. The rain gives us the sea to protect the boundaries of our land. It seems to me, and some commentators that I have read on this passage, that God performs a miracle here for his people Israel, just as he did with Moses, but with a little bit of a twist. Instead of making the waters part so that they could go on dry ground, he makes the dry ground wet. He soaks it in the dry season. There has come a torrential rain, out of season, at the wrong time. And Kishon suddenly becomes a fast-flowing torrent, and the ground is thick and muddy. What happens to these heavy iron chariots? They get stuck. They don't go anywhere. And this guy, Sisera, who's leading this, actually gets out of his chariot and runs for his life. Now listen to Deborah later. She sings this song. Listen to her song, recorded later, about this moment. The kings came and fought. Then fought the kings of Canaan. At Tanakh, near the waters of Megiddo, they took no plunder and silver. The stars fought from heaven for their courses. From their courses they fought against Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away. The ancient torrent, the torrent of Kishon. Judges 4:15, right there where you have your finger, simply says, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and all his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot, but Barak pursued the chariots and the army as far as Harosheth Bagayim. And all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not even one was left. So whether you agree with me or not, that God performs a miracle here and causes this parched ground to be suddenly muddy out of season, you can't escape this understanding from the text. While Barak and the Hebrews are obviously in battle, remember that two-tier thing I keep telling you? Two tiers. It's the word of God that tells us this battle was the Lord's. This battle belonged to God. And the Lord routed Sisera that day. It's the Lord who's in control. This theme keeps popping. This word routed is kind of a fascinating word. You and I might think of it as like defeated or profoundly defeated, you know. But its connotation means in confusion they were destroyed. Or they were crushed because they had been thrown into confusion. Something has happened. Something unexpected, something unexplainable, something chaotic has happened, and Sisera and his army and the Canaanites are freaked out. And it is their confusion over this incident that causes their demise. They couldn't understand it. By the way, it's the same word that's used of Pharaoh's chariots in Exodus chapter 14. So let me drive the point home for you this morning. Right over your heads. I meant it to go in one temple and out the other. Ah, she got it. Sisera leaves his chariot stuck in the mud. And he takes off running on foot. And he arrives in Heber and Jael's camp. And he's got to be thinking, oh, thank goodness. These are the people who have an agreement, an alignment, a peace treaty with King Jabin. These are the very people who told me that the Israelites were on our border. Woohoo! I have found a place to rest and hide. I'm safe. Now, in these nomadic tribes, the husbands and the wives have separate tents. Some of the wives are going, is that a bad idea, you know? And no one goes into the wives' tent other than the husband. No one is allowed anywhere near the wives' tent. But Sisera runs right into Jael's tent. And she might be thinking, what is this man coming into my tent telling me not to disclose, not to tell anyone where he is? What is this about? Or she might be thinking, why is the commander of the army of King Jabin running away? They must be losing. Who do I want to see be seen in alignment with? The victors or the losers? Either way, Sisera thinks he's safe, which is exactly where you want your enemy to be, thinking they're safe. He asks for some water. She gives him some milk, probably buttermilk. And she tucks him under this blanket so he can hide and sleep. Goes on here. But Jael, Heber's wife, this is kind of gross. You good, Jude? You might want to go like this for a minute. Took a tent peg and seized a hammer and went secretly to him and boom! Drove the peg into his temple and it went through into the ground. For he was sound asleep and exhausted. So he died. And later in Deborah's song, yeah, it's like, good! You know, this is right when you want to die, actually. You do not want to survive this wound. Later in Deborah's song, she describes this death as writhing and arching and bowing on the ground, but he can't get up. It's a gruesome death. So he died. And behold, as Barak pursued Sisera, Jael came out to meet him and said to him, come, I will show you the man whom you are seeking. And he entered with her, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with a tent peg in his temple. So, interesting story. A lot of things you shouldn't put on the text, and there's a lot you should see behind the text. You should know who these people are. But let's talk about a few applications that you should take with you this week. First of all, never, ever, ever fall asleep in a strange woman's bed. Okay? Just kidding. I mean, don't. Don't do that. But that's not the application I want you to have. Unless you have a habit of doing that, then that should be the application you have. Number two. Who's in control here? Who's in control this whole time? Yes, the tent peg. Thank you. You're dismissed. Go home. Let's talk about who thinks they're in control. The commanders and the kings think they're in control. The powerful, the wealthy, the ones who are in charge, ruling and oppressing and taunting and killing, they think they're in control. They're happy. Yeah, we'll take our chariots out. We're going to rout them. They have no weapons. We've taken them all away. We won't let them make any more. What are they going to do? Fight us with an ox goad? They are confident. Who's not happy? The Israelites. Why aren't they happy? Because they're not in control. Because they're oppressed. Because things are really difficult. You understand how your satisfaction often depends on who you think is in control, someone else or you? Someone else in your office, someone else in your family, or you? Someone else in your neighborhood, someone else in your church, or you? Why does your sense of satisfaction or fulfillment depend on who's in control? Why are we such control freaks? The entire time, God is in control. God is in control when these people are confident. God is in control when these people are in despair. God is in control when these people are proud of themselves. God is in control when these people are self-loathing. God is in control when everything makes sense, and God is in control when nothing makes sense. He's in control of the nations today. He's in control of the kings. He's in control of the armies today. He's in control of the churches. He's in control of the families. And yes, when you're happy or when you're not, when you're proud of yourself or when you're self-loathing, He is in control. The battle is the Lord's. The battle is the Lord's. Open your eyes to the two-tier system. What we don't see is more real than what we do. Trust Him. Obey Him. And finally, as you go this morning, she stood up. Deborah stood up when no one else did. When everyone else is doing what is right in their own eyes, when everyone else is worshiping their own opinions, when everyone else is embracing the culture around them, when God's chosen people are embracing the system and depending on the system to protect them or provide for them, when all of this was embracing them back, Deborah stood up. You are supposed to be God's standing stone in your sphere, in your school, in your family, in your workplace, in your neighborhood. You are supposed to be the one standing up and standing firm. You're supposed to be the one with truth. You're supposed to be the one with peace. Stand up. What pocket of sin are you allowing to remain in your life? What pocket of chaos are you focusing on and looking at? What philosophy? What principle of the world? What banner do they wave that you wave with them? What application of this world's ways do you use? Do you find convenient, enticing? Because it's going to end up owning you. It's going to end up enslaving you. It's going to end up being that burden that is so hard to get away from, that you cry out to the Lord over. Now, you've heard me talk about this that you've let remain for some weeks now, at least 3 or 4. And unless you're perfect, God is bringing something to your mind. Either you're perfect, or you're tone deaf. Identify it, own it, confess it, and let it go.